Blog Talk Radio.
Comes out of that university, Columbia University, right?
And the same amount comes out of Harvard University, a bunch of crap from that university. You got President Barack Obama, you know, a great constitutional scholar who won't release any of his work. You got all kinds of dildos, from that great institution that are nothing but, you know, whores, okay, intellectual whores. And, but this, in the celebration of intellect, Emerson, as he always did, he saw this, and he believed that universities and that scholarship should be free from these burdens, free from this. And this lecture is basically based on that, and the celebration of the intellect over all other things, you know, to keep the ideals of scholarship what they should have been, should be. And anyway, let me move on here. He starts, "I cannot consent to wander from the duties of this day into the fracas of politics. The brute noise of cannon has, I know, a most poetic echo in these days, when it is an instrument of freedom and the primal sentiments of humanity. Yet it is but representative and a far-off means and servant. But here in the college, we are in the presence of the constituency and the principle itself. Here is, or should be, the majesty of reason and the creative cause. And it were a compounding of all gradation and reverence to suffer the clash of swords and the boyish strife of passions and the feebleness of military strength to intrude on this sanctity and omnipotence of intellectual law. Against the heroism of soldiers, I set the heroism of scholars, which consists in ignoring the others. You shall not put up in your academy the stature of Caesar or Pompey, of Nelson or Wellington, or of Washington or Napoleon or Garibaldi, but of Archimedes, of Milton, of Newton. Archimedes disdained to apply himself to the useful arts, only to the liberal or the causal arts. Hero, the king, reproached him with his barren studies. Like Thales, he was willing to show him that he was quite able in rude matters, if he could condescend to them, and he conducted the defense of Syracuse against the Romans. Then he returned to his geometry, and when the Roman soldier at the sack of Syracuse broke into his study, the philosopher could not rise from his chair and his diagram, and took his death without resistance. Michelangelo gave himself to art, despising all meaner pursuits. When the war came to his own city, he lent his genius and defended Florence as long as he was obeyed. And Milton congratulates the Parliament that whilst London is besieged and blocked, the Thames infested, inroads and excursions round, and battle oft rumored to be marching up to her walls and suburb trenches, yet then are the people, or the greater part, more at other times wholly taken up with the study of highest and most important matters to be reformed. They being reasoning, reading, inventing, discoursing, even to a rarity and admiration, things not before discoursed or written, and the facts argue a just confidence in the grandeur and self-subsistency of the cause of religious liberty, which made all material war an impertinence. For either science and literature is a hypocrisy, or it is not. If it be, then resign your character to the legislature, turn your college into barracks and warehouses, and divert the funds of your founders into the stock of a rope walk or a candy factory or a candle factory, a tan yard, or some other undoubted convenience inconveniency for the surrounding population. But if the intellectual interest be, as I hold, no hypocrisy, but the only reality, then it behooves us to enthrone it, obey it, and give it possession of us and ours, to give among other possessions college into its hands, casting down every idol, every pretender, every whore, every dignified blunder that has crept into its administration. At this season, the colleges keep their anniversaries, and in this country, where education is a primary interest, every family has a representative in their halls, a son, a brother, or one of or own kindred in there for his training. But even if we had no son or friend therein, yet the college is part of the community, and it is there for us, is training for our teachers, civilizers, and inspirers. It is essentially the most radiating and public of agencies, like, but better than the lighthouse or the alarm bell or the sentinel who fires a signal cannon, or the telegraph which feeds the local news over the land. Besides, it deals with a force which it cannot monopolize or confine, cannot give to those who come to it and refuse to those outside. I have no doubt of the force, and for me the only question is whether the force is inside. The power which it deals is dear to all. If the colleges were better, if they had any monopoly of it, nay, if they really had it, had the power of imparting valuable thought, creative principles, truths which become powers, thoughts which become talents, if they could cause that a mind not profound should become profound, we should all rush to their gates. Instead of contriving inducements to draw students, you would need to set police at the gates to keep order in the inrushing multitude. These are giddy times, and you say the college will be deserted. No, never was it so much needed. But I say those were the giddy times which went before these, and the new times are the times of arraignment, times of trial and times of judgment. T is because the college was false to its trust, because the scholars did not learn and teach, because they were traitors and left their altars and libraries in worship of truth and played the sycophant to presidents and generals and members of Congress and gave degrees and literary and social honors to those whom they ought to have rebuked and exposed, incurring the contempt of those whom they ought to have put in fear. Then the college is suicidal, ceases to be a school. Power oozes out of it just as fast as truth does, and instead of overriding and strong and upholding the good, it is a hospital for decayed tutors. This integrity over all partial knowledge and skill, homage to truth, how rare. Few men wish to know how the thing really stands. What is the law of it without reference to persons? Other men are victims of their means. Sanity consists in not being subdued by your means. Two men cannot converse together on any topic without presently finding where each stands in moral judgment, and each learns whether the other's view commands or is commanded by his own. I presently know whether my companion has more candor or less, more hope for men or less, whether his sense of duty is more or less severe and his generosity larger than mine, whether he stands for ideal justice or for a timorous expediency. Society is always idolatrous and exaggerates the merits of those who work to vulgar ends. But genius may be known by its probity. Never was pure valor and almost, I might say, never pure ability shown in the bad cause, for ambition makes insane. I love this guy. I really love this guy. I do. Having been on the outskirts of the universe, having gone to college, of course, and having been involved with elementary and secondary programs as a teacher and substitute teacher and writer and lecturer and so on, I've come to realize that, you know, you really, it's impossible to criticize these institutions because they're so powerful. And at the same time, not just powerful, but so influential, the communities believe that they are teaching their children. And perhaps they are. But in this day and age, when you have 50% dropout rates from high schools, or 63% dropout rates in some cities, you really, really have to wonder, you know, what are they teaching? And why don't they want to learn? And it's come to my attention over the years that the curriculums are so boring in social studies and English and literature and so on. When I was in school, we gravitated to certain teachers in college and in elementary school even. Some teachers never had an attendance problem. Some teachers could always excite the student to learn. Those are great teachers. And I've been fortunate that I've had a number of them in my life, and but for all the few of those remarkable people, I've had some incredibly horrible teachers. I don't call them teachers, horrible people that would, you know, give absolutely irrelevant, boring assignments and so little concern for the student, you know, for their individual interests or their abilities. It was just a rubber stamp. You either pass or you fail. And I think that of all of the offenses that I've suffered through my intellectual career, as I say career, through my intellectual pursuits, studies, and academic studies, and so on, I've come to the conclusion, that for every 100 teachers or professors, there may be one that stimulates you, or is one that works with you, or one that inspires you. Just as there for one every 100 books of supposedly intellectual authority, there may be one or two simply project reality, how honestly can excite the imagination and inflame the hearts of youth or the hearts of an individual to pursue further and discover the truths that scholars are obliged to pursue, you know. That's what scholars do. And I don't know exactly. I don't know how many out there who are listening may have come up across the same thing, but same problems that I have over the years. But with the institutional learning, but there's no question, you know, no question that, you know, the American learning vacuum exists, and the tragedy of our public schools in this in the 21st century are the telltale signs, you know, of the kind of education that our children are receiving. So, anyway, let me go on without going without elaborating here. Power which it deals is dear to all. If a college were better, if they had any monopoly of it, nay, if they really had it, I read this already, sanity consists in not being subdued by your means. Two men cannot converse together in any topic. I read that, I'm sorry. I kind of lost my place here. But for ambition makes insane. Society is always taken by surprise by any new example of common sense and of simple justice, as at a wonderful discovery. Thus, at Mr. Rary's modes of taming a horse by kindness, or Garibaldi's emancipation of Italy for Italy's sake, at the introduction of gentleness into insane asylums, and of cleanliness and comfort into penitentiaries, a farmer wished to buy an ox. The seller told him how well he had treated the animal, but said, "My farmer, I asked the ox, and the ox showed me by marks that could not lie that he had been abused. And we affect to slight England and Englishmen. But I note that we had a vast self-esteem on the subject of Bunker Hill, Yorktown, and New Orleans. We should not think it much to beat Indians or Mexicans, but to beat English. The English newspapers and some writers of reputation disparage America. Meantime, I note that the British people are emigrating hither by thousands, which is a very sincere and apt to be a very seriously considered expression of opinion. The emigration into America of British, as well as of continental people, is the eulogy of America by the most competent and sincere arbiters. The hater of property and of government takes care to have his warranty deed recorded and the book written against fame and learning has the author's name on the title page." Hello, It's so true. It's so true. We're such hypocrites. And gentlemen, I too am an American and value practical talent. I love results and hate abortions. I delight in people who can do things. I value talent. Perhaps no man more. I value dearly the poet who knows his art so well that when his voice vibrates, it fills the hearer with sympathetic song, just as a powerful note of an organ sets all tuned strings in its neighborhood in accordant vibration. The novelist with his romance, the architect with his palace, the composer with his score, I wish you to be eloquent, to grasp the bolt and to hurl it home to the mark. I wish to see the Mirabeau who knows how to seize the heartstrings of the people and drive their hands and feet in the way he wishes them to go, to fill them with himself, to enchain the men so that their will and purpose is in abeyance, and they serve him with a million hands just as implicitly as his own members obey him. But I value it more when it is legitimate, when the talent is in true order, subject to genius, subject to the total and native sentiment of the man, and therefore in harmony with this public sentiment of mankind. Such is the patriotism of Demosthenes, of Patrick Henry, and of what was best in Cicero and Burke. Not an ingenious special pleading, not the making of a plausible case, but strong by the strength of the facts themselves. Then the orator is still one of the audience, persuaded by the same reason which persuade them. Not a ventriloquist, not a juggler, not a wire puller paid to manage the lobby and caucus. In Demosthenes, is this realism of genius? He wins his cause honestly. His doctrine is self-reliance. If it please you to note it, my counsels to you, now this is a quote that he states, if it please you to note it, my counsels to you are not such whereby I should grow great among you, and you become little among the Grecians. But they be of that nature, as is sometimes not good for me to give, but are always good for you to follow. You, gentlemen, are selected out of the great multitudes of your mates, out of those who began life with you, set apart through some strong persuasion of your own or of your friends, that you are capable of the high privilege of thought. Need enough there is of such a band of priests of intellect and knowledge. And great is the office, and well-deserving and well-paying this last sacrifices and the highest ability. But I wish this were a needless task to urge upon you scholars this claim of thought and learning. The order of the world educates with care the senses and the understanding. Men are as they think. A certain quantity of power belongs to a certain quantity of truth. And the man who knows any truth not yet discerned by other men is master of all other men, so far as the truth and its wide relations are concerned. Do you suppose that the thunderbolt falls short? Do you imagine that a lie will nourish and work like a truth? The whole battle is fought in a few heads. A little finer order, a larger angle of vision, commands centuries of facts and millions of thoughtless people. It reverses all rank. He who discriminates is the father of his father. And yet the world is not saved with the divine oracle. We somehow do not get instructed. Here are still perverse millions full of passion, crime, and blood. Here are bad governors and bad subjects. Nay, in the class called intellectual, the men are no better than the uninstructed. They use their wit and learning in the service of the devil. There are bad books and false teachers and corrupt judges, and in the institutions of education, a want of faith in their own cause. Nay, it happens often that the well-bred and refined and the inhabitants of cities dwelling amidst colleges, churches, and scientific museums, lecturers, poets, libraries, newspapers, and other aids, supposed intellectual, are more vicious and malignant than the rude country people and need to have their corrupt voting and violence corrected by the cleaner and wiser suffrages of poor farmers. The poet does not believe in his poetry. Men are ashamed of their intellect. Instinct is the name of the potential wit, that feeling which each has that what is done by any man or agent is done by the same wit as his. He looks at all men as his representatives, and is glad to see that his wit can work at that problem as it ought to be done, and better than he could do it, whether it be to build, engineer, carve, paint, sing, heal, or compute, or play chess, or ride, or swim. We feel as if one man wrote all the books, painted, built in dark ages, and we are sure we can do more than ever was done. It was the same mind that built the world. The understanding is the name we give to the low. Limitary power working to short ends, to daily life in house and street. This is the power which the world of men adopt and educate. He is the calculator. He is the merchant, the politician, the worker, and the useful. He works by shifts, by compromise, by statute, by bribes. All his activities are too short. Personal ends. And he is apt to be a talker, a boaster, a busybody. If you let me say to you what I think is the organic law of learning, will you let me say to you what is the organic law of learning? It is to observe the order, to keep down the talent, to enthrone the instinct. There must be the perpetual rallying and self-recovery. Each talent links itself so fast with self-love and with petty advantage that it loses sight of its obedience, which is beautiful, and sets up for itself and makes confusion. Falsehood begins as soon as it disobeys. It works for show and for the shop, and the greater it grows, the more is the mischief and misleading, so that presently all is wrong. Talent is mistaken for genius, dogma, or system for truth. And now, please remember that these words were written 150 years ago by one of the greatest American philosophers of all time. And he was giving this lecture at Harvard. Possibly to the graduating class. It didn't say that. The essay just said given to Harvard lecture 1870, but not to go off on a tangent, but what I wanted to say at this moment is that nothing has changed. If anything, it's become worse. And now our colleges have gotten to the point where they're, not only is their information irrelevant, but the cost of an irrelevant education has become astronomical. And bring children, our children, bringing young people into a lifetime of debt. for nothing, for falsehoods, for hypocrisy, for madness. No. No, I can't agree with what's going on now. Days, and the level of, or the quality, I should say, of graduates that are going through the system, 50% of them can't get jobs. 50% of them are unemployed or unemployable. So what does that tell you about the relevancy of what they're learning? It was told to me once that almost everything, whatever you learned 4 years ago, college, unless it was in the humanities of sorts, is obsolete as far as science and technology and whatnot. When I was going to college, back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, there were no cell phones, iPads. Everything was done by books. You know, there were no computers. Everything was read, researched by books and libraries and, lectures and so on. And the better the university, the greater its libraries were. I happened to go to a university in Connecticut, Central Connecticut University, and they had a tremendous library. They still do. A remarkable library. hundreds of thousands of books just and stacks. And they had built this library, and it was a state-of-the-art building. I would spend a good portion of every weekend in that library. On Saturdays, I would be there for as much as 7 or 8 hours a day, just reading different books that were totally unavailable, out of print editions and things. And of course, I was a history major and a history and English major. And I found just so many things. There are libraries, and I've always been a supporter of libraries, no question about it. But always had many, many books and bought, and always bought books. And I guess what I'm getting at is, early on in my life, I discovered the bliss of scholarly pursuit. It was wonderful, just to be able to read everything that I could get my hands on of great literature. I don't know why I gravitated that way, but I did, and my I at one time I put aside a very difficult reading schedule for myself. This was when I was in my 20s, of 300 books a year. That's crazy, I know. But I was a rather fast reader then. I don't read as fast now for some reason, but I was kind of like a sponge. I just couldn't get enough information. And these weren't just, novels or whatever. These were books of philosophy and books of on religion, and books on great books by great classic novels, things like that, historical novels. You know, and of course, I read a lot of, he used to read a lot of biographies, a lot of autobiographies, a lot of journals and things like that. I used to keep my own journals. I used to write all the time. Of course, I wrote many, many, many papers while I was in college. And, but I wanted to... the reason I got on this subject, and I won't take too much more time because I'd like to get through this essay, is that a great teacher, he's dead, he's passed away now, he died a number of years ago, but he told me, he always inspired me. I took a number of his classes. He had, the man had 3 or 4 PhDs, and he said, he told me, Leo, never stop learning. And he knew that I admired him greatly. I actually even worked for him in his college and his as an assistant and a tutor. And he was in history department. And he said, never stop learning, Leo. Never stop going to school. Never stop, you know, he says, never stop. And unfortunately, I couldn't afford to continue to go to school after I got my degree and so on and so forth. I had to start work. But I always read. I always developed reading lists and things and whatnot, and because I didn't have the discipline required to become an academic. So much of it was politics. So much of it was bullshit. You know, the curriculums that they wanted and to give you. And today it's even worse because you have to teach to the tests and, you know, stuff, and you really can't even teach things. Truth. So, you know, it's very difficult. But anyway, let me finish this tonight. Now the idea of a college is an assembly of such men, obedient each to his pure light, and drawing from it illumination to that science or art to which his constitution and affections draw him. And the very highest advantage which a young man of good mind can meet is to find such a teacher. No books, no aids, laboratory apparatus, prizes can compare with this. Here is sympathy. Here is an order that corresponds to that in his own mind and in all sound minds, and the hope and impulse imparted. And education is what it should be, a delightful unfolding of the faculties in right order. Oh man, this is so right. I could heartily wish it were otherwise. But there is a certain shyness of genius, of free thought, of a master of art in colleges, which is as old as the rejection of Molière by the French Academy, of Bentley by the pedants of his time, and only the other day of Arago in Oxford, and recent rejections of Max Müller. If the truth must be told, thought is as rare in colleges as in cities. This necessity of a mechanical system is not to be defined. Young men must be classed and employed, not according to the secret need. Not according to the secret needs of each mind, but by some available plan that will give weekly and annual results. And a little violence must be done to private genius to accomplish this. Then genius is always its own law and must be a little impatient and rebellious to this rule, so that of necessity A certain hostility and jealousy of genius grows up in the masters of routine, and unless by rare good fortune the professor has a generous sympathy with genius and takes care to interpose a certain relief and cherishing and reverence to the wild poet and dawning philosopher he has detected in his classes, that will happen, which has happened so often, that the best scholar, he for whom colleges exist, finds himself a stranger and an orphan therein. T is precisely analogous to what befalls in religious societies. In the romance Spiritum a few years ago, we had what it seems was a piece of accurate autobiography, the story of a young saint who comes into a convent for her education, and not falling into the system and the little parties in the convent, but inspired with an enthusiasm which finds nothing there to feed it. It turns out in a few days that every hand is against this young votary. Piety in a convent accuses everyone, from the novice to the abbess. And what right have you to be better than your neighbor? Piety comes to be regarded as a spy and a rebel. And how often we have had repeated and trials of the young man who made no figure at college because his own methods were new and extraordinary, and who only prospered at last because he forsook theirs and took his own. It is true that the university and the church, which should be counterbalancing institutions to our great material institutions of trade and territorial power, do not express the sentiment of the popular politics and the popular optimism, whatever it be. College, Harvard College, has no voice in Harvard College, but State Street votes it down on every ballot. Everything will be permitted there that goes to adorn Boston Whiggism. Is it geology, astronomy, poetry, antiquities, art, rhetoric, but that which it exists for? To be a fountain of novelties out of heaven, a Delphos, uttering warnings and ravishing oracles to lift and lead mankind, that it shall not be permitted to do or to think of. On the contrary, every generosity of thought is suspect and gets a bad name, and all the youth come out decrepit citizens, not a prophet, not a poet, not a demon, but in gagged and stifled or driven away. All that is sought in the instruction is drill, tutors, not inspirers. Boy, is that so true even today. Especially today. I conceive that a college should have no mean ambition, but should aim at a reverent discipline and invitation of the soul that here, if nowhere else in the world, genius should find its home. Here, imagination should be greeted with the problems in which it delights. The noblest task the muse proposed and the most cordial and honoring rewards. Here, the highest duties be urged, and enthusiasm for liberty and wisdom should breed enthusiasm and form heroes for the state. The college should hold the profound thought, and the church, the great heart to which the nation should turn. And these two should be counterbalancing to the bad politics and selfish trade. But there is but one institution and not three. The church and the college now take their tone from the city and do not dictate their own. You all well know the downward tendency in literature, the facility with which men renounce their youthful aims and say, the labor is too severe, the prize too high for me, and they accept the employments of the market. Ah, gentlemen, it's only a dream of mine, and perhaps never will be true. But I thought a college was a place not to train talents, not to train attorneys, and those who say what they please, but to adorn genius, which only speaks truth, and after the way which truth uses, namely beauty, a college was to teach you geometry, or the lovely laws of space and figure, chemistry, botany, zoology, the streaming of thought into form, and the precipitation of atoms, which nature is. This, then, is the theory of education, the happy meeting of the young soul filled with desire, with the living teacher, who has already made the passage from the center forth, step by step, along the intellectual roads to the theory and practice of special science. Now, if there be genius in the scholar, that is, a delicate sensibility to the laws of the world, and the power to express them, again, in some new form, he is made to find his own way. He will greet joyfully the wise teacher, but colleges and teachers are no wise essential to him. You will find teachers everywhere. I would have you rely on nature ever. Wise, omnific, thousand-handed nature, equal to each emergency, which can very well without colleges, can do very well without colleges. And if the Latin, Greek, algebra, or art were in the parents, they will be in the children without being pasted on. If your college and your literature are not felt, it is because the truth is not in them. When you say the times, the persons are prosaic, there is the feudal, or the Saracenic, or Egyptian architecture. Where the romantic manners? Where the romantic manners? Where are the Romish or the Calvinistic religion, which made a kind of poetry in the air for Milton or Byron or Belzoni? But to us it is barren. You expose your atheism. Is a railroad or a shoe factory or an insurance office, bank or bakery outside of the system and connection of things, or further from God than a sheep pasture or a clam bake? Is chemistry suspended? Do not the electricities and imponderable influences play with all their magic undulations? Do not gravity and polarity keep their unerring watch on the needle and thread, on a cobbler's lapstone or a switchman's turntable, as to the moon's orbit? Only being a deep observer, and he will make light of a new shop, of old cathedral, all one to him, or new circumstances that afflict you. You will find the circumstances not altered, as deep a cloud of mystery on the cause, as dazzling a glory on the invincible law. Is it so important whether a man wears a shoe buckle or ties his shoe lappet with a string? Bring the insight, and he will find as many beauties and heroes and astounding strokes of genius close by him as Shakespeare or Aeschylus or Dante beheld. It is in a beggary health farm. It was in a mean country inn that Burns found his fancies so sprightly. You find the times and places mean. My friend, stretch a few threads over a common aeolian harp and put it in your window and listen to what it says of times and the heart of nature. I do not think that you will believe that the miracle of nature is less, the chemical power worn out. Watch the breaking morning, the enchantments of the sunset. If I had young men to reach, I should say to them, keep the intellect sacred, revere it, give all to it. Its oracles countervail all. Attention is its acceptable prayer. Sit low and wait long, and know that next to being its minister, like Aristotle, and perhaps better than that, is the profound reception and sympathy, without ambition, which secularizes and trades it. Go sit with the hermit in you, and who knows more than you do. You will find life enhanced and doors open to grander entertainments. Yet all comes easily that he does, as snow and vapor, heat, wind, and light. Power costs nothing to the powerful. I should say to them, do what you can do. He that draws on his own talent cannot be overshadowed or supplanted. Homage to truth discriminates good and evil. Power never departs from it. Our colleges may differ much in the scale of requirements and the examination of admission, and the examination of degrees and honors may be lax in this college and severe in that. And you may find facilities, translations, syllabuses, and tutors here or there to coach you through. But 'tis very certain that an examination is yonder before us, and an examining committee that cannot be escaped nor deceived, that every scholar is to be put fairly on his own powers and must hear the questions proposed and answer them by himself and receive honor or dishonor according to the fidelity shown. For the men and women of your time, the circle of your friends and employers, your conditions, the invisible world, are the interrogators. When the great painter was told by a dober, I have painted 5 pictures, whilst you have made 1, he replied. Bingo in Aeternitum, study for eternity, smiled on me, says Van Helmont, and it were a good rule to read some lines at least every day that shall not be of the day's occasion or task, but of study for eternity. I had detained you too long, but it is privilege of the moral sentiment to be every moment new and commanding, and old men cannot see the powers of society, the institutions, the laws under which they have lived, passing or soon to pass into the hands of you and your contemporaries, without the earnest wish that you have caught sight of your high calling, your vast possibilities, and inspiring duties. And that says it all. And he said this back in 1870 to Harvard, and they didn't learn that. And they got worse, you know. But Emerson made a lot of enemies. A lot of enemies. And a lot of admirers. But his powerful words were based upon his mind, his powerful mind, and his dedication to free thinking, you know. Yes, he went through a lot of trouble and a lot of problems, but he stuck to it, and he became the great man that he became. And because of that, I'm here reading this stuff to you tonight in all admiration of his work. And I hope you got something from this. If not, I suggest that you might want to go to his works. I'm reading them from the complete works of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Just go to rwe.org. rwe.org. The complete works of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Okay? And you can get all this stuff there. So I want to thank you tonight, and I want to thank you for joining me. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I wish you the very best. And join us next week. We won't be on tomorrow, but join us next week when we have George Dixon and our special guest, Peter Moon. And he'll be discussing his newest book called The Mystery of Egypt, First Donald. Okay, so good night, everybody.